Ok, hello students, let's continue with the lecture about ADHD. This picture must now become quite familiar to you. When you start a task, then you are in an optimal state, an optimal physiological state, which means that the performance you produce is fast and not so variable, and with only few errors. But then at a certain moment, you start to feel that you jump into a so-called non-optimal state. And then two things can happen. You accept the fact that you are becoming in a non-optimal, drowsy, boring state, so to speak. And you accept the fact that there is a drop in performance efficiency, or there are reasons to become motivated and to try to keep the performance efficiency at the same level as before. So it's fighting against a non-optimal state to remain into a so-called optimal state. And that fight that is related to physiological costs. And we have discussed three different indices: the heart rate variability, the event-related potentials, and the fMRI, mirroring the brain activity. And all the three approaches point into the same direction, and that is that people with ADHD who are carrying out such a task, that they are not, let's say, fighting, they are not motivated, and the drop is there. The fact that there are three physiological indices pointing into the same direction, that is, of course, strong evidence in favor of the state regulation deficit, because the heart rate findings were carried out in the Netherlands. One PhD student of mine was involved in a type of research. The event-related potential studies were carried out in Belgium. So again, different samples of children with ADHD were participating. And the fMRI study was carried out in Canada. So again, a different group of ADHD people. And the Canadian study contained adults, young adults with ADHD, because we didn't get permission to invite children with ADHD using the fMRI equipment. So from three different angles, it's shown that people with ADHD have a state regulation deficit. And why do I call it a state regulation deficit? Because here the state is optimal, and here regulation, state regulation is needed to lifting it up, the state. The people with ADHD don't. And other research has shown that people with ADHD are also very easily overactivated, and then they don't have the regulation abilities to dampen their state. So this is in short what we have discussed last time, and it refreshes your memory. Now we are arrived at the issue of error processing. Is it so that the people with ADHD don't recognize don't become aware of the fact that the performance efficiency is declining. So is it connected, that state regulation deficit, with a monitoring disability? We have discussed the term monitoring disability and error processing when we were discussing the group of children with cerebral palsy. Do you remember? Now here we have plotted reaction times of the controls and the people with ADHD. And what you see here is the mean reaction time of errors. Here we have the mean reaction time of correct responses. And here we have the mean reaction time of a correct response after an error has been made. And then you can see that the errors are going together with fast reaction times. Well, when you are now getting familiar with the Pew curve, you understand this. Because buildup of information is needed. What do I see? And when you are simply fast and are reacting before the real decision can be made, well, then, as a consequence, you are, of course, then fast, but you make an error. Here we have the correct responses of both groups, and they are slower than the error responses. And here in the control group, you see at the reaction time level that there is a slight increase. So correct responses are slower than errors, but after an error, the correct response is even a little bit slower in the control group. So it reflects the fact that people in a control group become aware of the error making and start to slow down their reaction times in order to prevent errors. And here in the people with ADHD, you don't find it back that a correct response after an error, and here correct responses as such, it is a straight line. And here, we have discussed this earlier. Here we were interested in the electrical brain response. So here we plotted the reaction times. And when reaction times are correct, and you start to investigate what the brainwave after correct responses, then you see that it goes this direction. And the people with ADHD and the controls didn't differ with respect to that wave. But when an error has been made here, then you see that it first go up and then goes this direction. And there are no differences found with respect to the first peak, the error-related negativity. But the second peak, it is a positive peak, because remember, here this is positive and this is negative, that the second wave in the controls is much more pronounced than in the people with ADHD. The first wave, no differences. It means the awareness of the error. The second wave means what to do. That you put energy into the task in order to prevent future errors. So it means that the people with ADHD are aware of the fact that they are making errors, but they don't draw the consequences. That is one way to interpret it. Well, we have, of course, investigated error processing in adults with ADHD, in children with ADHD. We have investigated error processing in different age groups, children against adults. And then you see that the error processing is increasing as function of age. And that type of research also showed that adults and children with ADHD, they have about the same profile. So returning to the issue of is it so that the state regulation deficit is in a sense connected to error processing, not being aware of it? Well, yeah. It's an indication that both issues are connected. Here we have the brain activity after error making. We investigated this also in the Canadian group of people with ADHD, adults, as I have just told you. And here we ask the computer the question, okay, give me the areas in the brains where more activity is taking place in the controls against ADHD. And then you see a lot of red areas, which means more activity in comparison to the ADHD group. And when you ask the question, give me the areas in the ADHD people after error making, then you see that nothing happens. So also with respect to error making, you see that the brain activity is more pronounced in the controls after error making. And here you can read that conclusion. Brain activity after error making is most pronounced in the control group. So we have now talked about the physiological costs. The controls are able to remain at an optimal state level by regulating their state. The people with ADHD are less able in that state control, and especially the thalamic areas are related to that inability. And now we are arrived to discuss a new topic. And that topic is related to the so-called default network activity. So we have in the brain some areas and they are connected and they are labeled the default network activity, and it might be related to boredom. Oh, here we are. So in the 90s, it is 2001. In the 90s. A very important article was published. This is the first author. And it was published in Proceedings, National Academy of Science, USA. This is the volume and here the page numbers. And in that article, that was the first article, and it suggested that on the basis of functional MRI, two anti-correlational networks are present in the brain. Anti-correlational. And the first network is called the task positive network. And this part of the brain, which frontal, parietal, it is attention demanding, it becomes active when the subject is involved in carrying out a cognitive task and is active, doing his best. He is going through all the steps of the cognitive processes we have discussed. You have to encode, you have to search in your memory, you have to make decisions. And when you are actively involved in that task, then the task positive network becomes active. And then we have, according to these authors, a so-called task negative default mode network. And that is that when you are involved in a task and you become bored, you start to daydream. You are not any longer active involved in carrying out a task, then this network becomes operational. So why are we talking here about anti-correlational? It is simply because it is either this part of the brain is involved, or when you start to become to daydream or to sleep or to think about other things, you become bored, then it is the task negative default mode network, because which becomes operational. So it is either this or that. And it could be that when we return to the issue of trying to keep your state in an optimal shape in order to carry out a task, that it's a constant fight between those two networks. Yeah? And you can understand already that later on in this talk, it would be of interest to test, and that is what we did, whether the people with ADHD have an active task negative default mode network, especially in conditions with a slow event rate. That is, of course, the outcome, whereas the controls may still be involved in the task, and that it is related to an active positive attention network. Okay. Task negative default mode network. And there are different connotations you can find in the literature. The wandering mind, daydreaming, internally focused on tasks. And here we have suboptimal motivational status. Well, this connotation comes close to what we are talking all the time. So try to imagine that these four umbrellas, these are nothing more or less than psychological interpretations of what is going on when this task negative default mode network becomes active. I mean, you can say, well, it is an expression of the wandering mind, etc., etc. And or you can say, now we talk about suboptimal motivational states. I mean, that it is a matter of taste in that sense. But these are the four connotations you will find in the literature. So returning to our formal model, we can say that the controls, they keep the task efficiency at an optimal level. So it means that in their case, the task positive network is and remains active. Whereas in the people with ADHD, the task negative default mode network becomes more active due to the event rate manipulation. Do you remember that here we have, let's say, the fast event rate? So then in both groups, the task positive network is involved. But in the boring task, especially in the people with ADHD, this task negative network could become more active in the group. Here we have a figure of the regions included in the default mode network. So there are three parts in the brain: the superior and medial prefrontal cortex. We call that the anterior component. So it is frontal, the prefrontal cortex. Then we have here the lateral component, that is more here. That's called the angular gyrus. And then we have also an area behind the posterior cingulate cortex. So there are three areas, and the lateral areas, there are two, and this is the back, and this is the front. And they together are put under the umbrella of default mode network. And here we have our findings. The brain activity of the default mode network during a fast event rate, a medium event rate, and a slow event rate for these three parts of the default mode network I have just discussed with you. Yeah? And here we can read fast, medium, slow, fast, medium, slow, fast, medium, and slow. And here we have the three areas. The third area. And here we have the ADHD group and the controls. So let's start with the fast event rate. Then you can see that already during the fast event rate, the default mode network is more operational. It is less the case during the moderate, but look in the slow. Then you see that that network, which again is related to task negativity, not being attentive anymore, that here the findings are most pronounced during the slow event rate. So here we can discuss hours and hours what is taking place here, but this is, let's say, the information. This concerns the A region of the default mode network. Let's have a look at this other part. Again, you see that when it comes to the slow event rate, again, in the people with ADHD, the activation of the default mode network And I repeat myself over and over that part of the brain which is becoming active when you are getting bored, when you become to be demotivated, becomes, let's say, most pronounced. And also in the C part, you see the same. So with respect to the three parts of the default mode network, it shows that in the slow condition, and here, the brain areas which are connected with demotivation, less energy allocation, that part of the brain is most pronounced in the people with ADHD. So, in conclusion, default mode network in ADHD is most active in the slow condition. Is this an expression of boredom? Well, if we go back to one of the four interpretations of an active default mode work network, then we must say yes, it must be an expression of boredom. So far we have discussed the physiological indices, heart rate variability, P300 amplitude, fMRI activity, and they all point in the direction of diminished effort allocation, and also diminished energy, diminished motivation in ADHD children. And the results I just have shown you shows that the task-positive attentional network becomes less active, and that default mode network becomes more active. So it all points into the same direction, and that is people with ADHD becomes easily bored. Now we are arrived at another dependent variable, another index. And then we talk about observational studies. So in some of these studies, we were filming the behavior of the participants, the children with ADHD, and the control group. And we were in particularly interested in facial expressions, because it could be the case that you can also read out of their faces that those people with ADHD become more bored during the slow event rate condition. And one way to study the facial expressions, that is by means of Ekman and Friesen, and they published in 1978 a methodology to study facial expressions, and it is called the FACS, facial action coding system. And it is based on, this tool is based on muscle movements in the face. And the units of the movements are defined in terms of expressions. Yeah? This is Ekman, and he used this picture. And here we have so-called upper face action units. So this is, of course, then the upper face, and this is the lower face. And behind the skin, we have, of course, all kinds of muscles. And all together, by means of using the muscles, we humans are expressing our feelings. Feelings of happiness, feelings of sadness. And it is all a matter of defining, investigating. That is what Ekman and Friesen did. They investigated when people are expressing feelings of sadness, feelings of disgust, feelings of happiness. So they were, for instance, in one of those studies, Ekman and Friesen were inviting actors. And the actors got a sheet of paper, and then they had to make a face belonging to one of those feelings. And Ekman and Friesen, they were filming the behavior, and they were very precise in noting which so-called action units becoming operational when we are discussing, when we are talking about expressions of emotions. Here we have upper face action units. You can also understand that the lower face, there are all kinds of action units, for instance, around the lips. There are also action units like showing your tongue, etc., etc., etc. And what is studied is, let's say, the frequency and the duration of muscles which become operational when expressing a feeling. You really need to become an expert in that. You really have to read the manual. It takes a lot of time before you are able to, able to score these issues. And it is a lot of work because you can't when you are filming the behavior. Can't score all the action units at once. No, you have to go 20 times or maybe 40 times through one film of a few minutes, and every time you are then focused on one or two action units. And when it is becoming operational, according to you, you have to push buttons which are in front of you. So you must imagine that when you were one of my students and you were involved in these projects and you had to look at the face of a child executing one of these tasks we have discussed earlier, and you were instructed to look at one or two of those action units. You see it, you push a button, and when the action unit stops, you again push the same button, and that information goes then, of course, to a computer. So we create then a file with on and off action units. It could be that, and most of the times it is the case, that you need more than one observer, let's say two observers for one film, because the observers may differ with respect to when an action unit is becoming operational or not. So you compare then, the computer is doing that. The computer is then comparing the on and off file of observer one with the on and off files of observer two. And when the difference is more than 500 milliseconds, then you can investigate that part of the film again happened. And that is the way we did it. So you get a very precise way of the muscle activity during task execution. Now here we have the facial movements and emotions, and then it could be that stress is indexed by the sum of the facial movements. So you simply, at a certain moment, sum all the facial movements. And that is then an index of stress. And emotions like fear, anger, disgust, and boredom, they are negative emotions associated with particular facial movements. Well, this is what we need with respect to boredom. Do you remember? We are going to use this type of measure in ADHD. And here we have, I have designed for you all kinds of interesting facial movements, the brow raiser, brow lower, blink of the eye, eyes down, lip corner puller, tongue show, lip pressure, lips part, mouth stretch, lip sucks, jaw, and puff. And only a few studies have been carried out on these issues. And on the basis of these few studies, it could be the case that brow lower and blink are connected with fear and anger. Well, we are not interested in that. But when you are interested, let's say, in patients who are showing a lot of fear and anger, anxiety disorder, for instance, then you think about these behavioral observations focused on this. Here we have boredom. And that boredom was connected to eyes down. Eyes down. And here we have also disgust, but that is also not so much of interest as far as our work is concerned. So here we have one of our findings. This is an extremely boring task. It had a duration of 24 minutes without breaks. And when we were talking about reaction times, then we have discussed that you will have a drop in performance over time, and that drop will be most pronounced in the people with ADHD, yeah? But here we have the outcome of behavioral observations, namely the number of movements made in the face. And then you can see that the people with ADHD are all the time making more movements than the controls, except for this dot. But yeah, that could also be chance level, when you have so many comparisons to make. There is always exceptions, but even here it is not the case that the controls are showing more movements in this interval of 8 minutes. So overall, the people with ADHD show more facial expressions. And this could be an index of stress. so that they experience more stress overall, but also more stress when the task duration progresses. You can see that there is an increase. Whereas in the controls, except for this point here, it is a straight line. So over time, the people with ADHD are showing more stress. When you use the number of facial movements as an index of stress, I mean, it is a matter of you choose for certain indexes. And when you say, well, this is an index of stress, then the interpretation is people with ADHD are experiencing more stress. Here, we have plotted the individual action units, the brow raising, brow lowering, etc., etc. In fact, all the action units we have discussed, and the only action unit which really is significant different between the controls and the ADHD group is eyes down. And for those who have carefully listened to this talk so far, eyes down was an expression of boredom. So on the one hand, the people with ADHD show more stress when we sum up all the action units, and on the other hand, it is more stress. It is boredom. It looks like that this is also significant, but that is not the case. So believe me, only when we talk about eyes down, then we found differences. So we have, with respect to the outcome, more facial movements, stress. I put it behind the question mark. And when we are looking to the action units individually, then they could be bored. So what is now the connection between stress and boredom? Well, for those who would like to write a paper about this issue, it is really difficult to differentiate between stress and boredom. Overall, a lot has been published about stress, maybe not stress and ADHD, but stress as such, and very little about boredom, although I think that boredom is a key of our existence, and it is very strange that in the field of psychology, very little research has been carried out around the issue of boredom. But anyhow, it is use these two terms interchangeable. So, for instance, boredom is a flavor of stress. And that is very old research, Richard Tackley, 91, the stress of boredom and monitory. Psychosomatic Medicine, 43, and here the page numbers. So in a quite old research, I found a very interesting title, The Stress of Boredom and Monitory. Then you will also find all kinds of definitions of boredom. in the little literature, by the way, for instance, the state of being weary and restless through lack of interest. So here you see restless. Well, that could be a symptom of ADHD. Lack of interest. No, that could be lack of motivation. And then we have here a state of low arousal, low activity level, and dissatisfaction attributed to an inadequate stimulating environment. So we were also talking about this stimulating environment. If we compare a fast event rate against a slow event rate, then the slow event rate is an inadequate stimulus environment. So in a sense, all these concepts have a lot of similarities. And here we have a very interesting model, circumplex model. And Russell and Poster, they have developed this model. And you see here the word activation. And that the activation is, of course, opposite deactivation. And then we have deactivation, activation, and here we have unpleasant against pleasant. And what Russell and Posner tried to do was to postulate all kinds of emotions between those words. For instance, from activation to pleasant, alert, excited, to happy, and then here, serene, relaxed, calm, deactivation, and here you will find the word boredom. It comes close to deactivation. I can understand it. And it is also close to unpleasant. So here is boredom. And here we have the word stress. It lays between unpleasant and activation. So returning to our issue, that on the one hand, the behavioral expressions of children with ADHD, and also adults, by the way, they tell us they are stressed, and on the other hand, they are bored. So when we look at certain action units, then it seems bored, but when we sum it up, the action units, it is stressed. It is connected, I've shown to you those two expressions, but according to this model, stress is something different than being bored. Let's see what our findings tell us, and this has not been published so far. ADHD. And we also have controls. And in the ADHD group, we were correlating the facial activity with the reaction times and with the heart rate variability. And in the controls, there was no correlation, but in the ADHD group, there was. You see, between facial activity and reaction time, the correlation ranged between 29 to 52. It depends on what type of reaction times and what type of facial activity. And here, there is also a connection between facial activity and heart rate variability. So it is not out of the question that in people with ADHD, the facial activity is saying boredom, which is producing slow reaction times and many errors. We have discussed that. And in addition to that, the physiological system is also correlated with the facial activity in that sense. The more bored they become, expressed in the heart rate, you see it back in the facial activity. Now, this is the mesolimbic system in the brain, and that is connected with what we have told. And here we have the dopamine issue related to the prefrontal cortex and the striatum as a function of age. I have told to you when this is the brain, then as a starter, the striatum is operational, and as a function of age, the skills goes to the prefrontal cortex. So in young children, the striatum is dominating the prefrontal cortex. In adolescents, it is a fight. And in adults, the prefrontal cortex is taking over the functions of the striatum. And when we talk about children with ADHD, it is especially that the striatum is operational, prefrontal cortex enter less. And when we talk about adults, then we slowly and slowly start to talk about different areas in the brain. Okay, this was the lecture about ADHD. We have a break of 5 minutes, and I try to change the file into another one. The first slide, autism. And that is an inborn weakness in emotional contact, as has been put forward by Leo Kanner. And he started to investigate autism in 1943. There is also another one, Asperger. Okay, this is the second slide. And 80% of the parents recognize symptoms before the child is 12 months. Then you must think about speech language delay. At the matter of fact, 30% of the children are mute. They don't talk at all. It can happen that children are starting talking, but after a while, they simply stop talking and they become mute. And that is a very severe issue. And in the clinical practice, a lot of interventions have been developed to increase the speech language. You can imagine that for parents, it is very difficult to get in contact with children when they don't talk or they are delayed in their speech language abilities. Then we have abnormal social behavior. Well, you may think about playing with children. That can be very complicated. You try to do your best as a caretaker. You try to play with them, to give them some toys, but they hardly play with it. Maybe they smash things away, or they do totally different things with the toys. They have attentional problems. They have sleep disorders, and may also have eating disorders. And you may think about eating only specific issues. Eating only specific issues having the same color. And it must be served in a plate which is always the same, etc., etc., and people are eating very badly. So all in all, if you look at these issues, speech language delays, abnormal social behavior, attentional problem, sleep problem, eating problem, there is more to mention. Also, I think that about 30% of the children have problems with toileting. They don't interpret the need to go to the toilet, and then you can imagine what happens. You can also imagine what happens when they have a problem with toileting training with respect to the school. Now, in 25% of the cases, problems manifest as a regression. So first, the development is okay. And then when children have reached the age of 1 or 2 years, then there is a regression. So you can imagine that for caretakers, it is really a load to raise those children. And when students are interested in writing a paper about these issues, how loading it is to take care of such children, then you are really invited to write such a paper. Okay, next slide, please. The diagnosis is based on weak social interactions. Well, that is overlapping the first slide, that the diagnosis, according to Kanner, is based on weak social interactions. We may say that the diagnosis becomes quite reliable after the age of 2. So you must imagine that children and parents are going to special institutes who are well equipped to diagnose autism. And then on the basis of how well you can get contact with those children by means of playing and making designs together, the diagnosis is made. There were different types of autistic disorder, Asperger. Then we talk about high-functioning people with autism. So then we talk about children with an IQ above the 80. It even can be that the IQ is very high, 130, 140. And then we have here pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, PDD-NOS. It means that these children are not fulfilling all the requirements to get the diagnosis of autism, but they fulfill parts of the diagnosis. It doesn't mean that the problem is less severe when you don't meet all the criteria. When you don't meet all the criteria, because it can be very tough to have a child who have part of the fulfilling part of the diagnosis. And nowadays we talk about an umbrella term, autism spectrum disorder. I can't say that people who are working in the field are so happy with the fact that these subtyping has disappeared from the diagnosis. But at the same time, it seems that all the research carried out in order to differentiate between the subtypes were not so successful. So on the one hand, there are clinical reasons to maintain subtyping. On the other hand, it is quite difficult to differentiate, and now we speak about autism spectrum disorder. Next slide, please. What I'm now going to do with you is to go through all kinds of characteristics of autism. And the target is to show you how complicated it is to form a experimental group, because it seems that children who are all fulfilling the diagnosis of autism, that they may be so different with respect to the behavior they show. And I will make this clear in explaining to you that there are different impairments. So the first set of impairments concerns qualitative impairments in social interactions. So keep this into your mind. And now, yeah, then we can read it a little bit. Eye-to-eye gaze. So people with autism, they have the tendency not to look at you in a straight way. Then we have facial expressions. They are not showing many facial expressions. The same holds with respect to the language. They don't change the pitch of the voice. It's very monotonous in many respects. Body postures, body gestures. When we are discussing, then we are using a lot of gestures. And in people with autism, it is practically absent. And that all is hindering, of course, social interactions. Then there is a failure to develop peer relations. So many people with autism, they also are lonely. And some research is focused on loneliness of those people, and the main difference between their loneliness and the loneliness of people without autism is that people with autism, they prefer to be alone, and people without autism, they consider this to be quite painful when they don't have so many relations. But it is wrong to think that people with autism has no friends. Maybe they have one or two friends, and that's it. Then a lack of spontaneous seeking to share enjoyment, interest, lack of social or emotional reciprocity. Reciprocity, that is the word, of course, that really is a key in social interactions. You talk, the other person is listening, but when the other person is not really listening, then there is no reciprocity with respect to the verbal interactions. It is one-way traffic. So these are all features. There are more to mention that can be put under the umbrella of quality impairments in social interactions. And try to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And there are more to mention. Let's go to the second one. New slide, please. 5. Then there are qualitative impairments in communication. There is a delay or total lack of spoken language. There is an inability to initiate or sustain a conversation. Stereotype and repetitive use of language. Lack of varied, spontaneous play. So again, we have five different aspects of qualitative impairments. And when we start to count, then we come now already to 17 different behavioral types which are connected with the diagnosis. Next slide, please. And here we have restricted, repetitive, and stereotype patterns of behavior, interests, and activities. Preoccupation with one or more restricted patterns. So many people with autism, they have only one toy to play with. That's what they like. Inflexible. Everything remains to be the same. Non-functional routines, rituals. When you count this, then we are already around 20, 25 different aspects of behavior all connected to autism. May I have the next slide? And here we have two diagnostic instruments which are often used in qualify all the characteristics we have just discussed. Next slide, please. And now it comes. You can read here that a total of six or more items for criterion 1, 2, and 3 are needed to get the diagnosis. So it means that when you start to calculate and you invite 20 people with autism for your experiment, and you compare the outcome of your task with a control group, then those people with autism may all be different. It is, in fact, an extremely heterogeneous population. And this is of importance with respect to the rest of this talk, that researchers, at best, they can compare only 20 cases with autism with 20 cases without autism. It means that the findings are, by definition, then quite unreliable, because the groups of people who are involved in the research might be all different. And that is why the field is so difficult to interpret, because many research findings are contradictory. Now it is time to talk also about adults with autism. The laymen are used to think about autism in terms of youngsters. And they forget that youngsters become older. And then the question is, what happens with people when they grow older? What happens with their autism characteristics? And this is quite recently that research becomes more and more interested in also adults with autism. The other thing I would like to say to you is that if you want to understand something about pathology, developmental pathology, then it is good to realize that we all, also you and I, we might show now and then signs of autism, signs of ADHD, signs of depression. But when it comes to disorder, then you only have to put in front of that characteristic the word two. They are two showing those signs of autism. And there is also, of course, a huge group of people, for instance, adults, who are not fulfilling all the requirements of autism. but still come very close to the disorder. And unfortunately, people in the field hardly recognize this. And I would like to give you an example of, let's say, a person who is not fulfilling the diagnosis of autism, but comes close to it. Well, it might be the case that those people you can find many times in the field of formal sciences, for instance. Once there has been carried out in the Netherlands some research in the city of Eindhoven, where we have those huge Philips factories, and a lot of engineers are working there, and autism is overrepresented in those areas, but maybe not in terms of people who are fulfilling the requirements, but they are coming close to it. Let's go to the first issue. What can happen to an engineer who is not fulfilling all the requirements to get the diagnosis of autism, of the autism spectrum disorder? Well, one characteristic of such a person is that he has difficulties in lying. Why difficulties in lying? Simply because he is hardly able to lie. In order to lie, the ability to lie, that means that you have the ability of high cognitive characteristics, like you know how to read from the face of another, how he is thinking about you. You know, as a non-person with autism, that when you are saying something, that it might lead to consequences. Well, that means a social ability. So lying as such, it belongs to a high cognitive level. And people with autism, they hardly can interpret the social world around them. So as a matter of fact, they can't become aware of the fact that a lie leads to consequences. So for instance, when you ask me, do you like your boss? I will immediately say, yes, I like my boss, because I know the consequences when he would hear that I am saying to you that I don't like him. Do you understand me? Do you understand me that lying as such is a way to survive in this world? And research has shown that normal people are maybe lying 15 to 20 times per day. You are able to lie when you understand the social context. When you don't understand it, then you are not able to lie. And as a result, when you are working in a laboratory, we are talking now about a person, an engineer, who is not fulfilling all the requirements, he will create a lot of problems because of the fact that he has difficulties in lying. He has difficulties in manipulating. That comes close to this. He is not flexible. This also leads to another problem. Take, for instance, the issue that the boss of that engineer is at a certain day saying, well, you have to finish this work this evening, which is, let's say, practical, impossible when it is a lot of work. When my boss is asking me to do that, then at a certain moment I start to read in a diagonal way, because I can say, well, this is it. I stop. I want to protect myself. But when you are not flexible, then you are bringing yourself into harm, because people with autism, and that will also be shown in our research we will discuss with you, they hardly make errors. They are very punctual, and they continue and continue. So as a result, when they come home, they are extremely tired because they want to finish things. They are working, the bosses of these people are most of the time very satisfied with these workers because they finish things, they don't make errors. But as a result, when those people become 50, they could become burned out. And I'm telling you this because in the clinical practice, many people don't recognize autism in older people who are still working. And they need, let's say, courses to recognize those issues. They are very, very loyal to their work, and at a certain moment, they are exhausted. What happens when there is a new boss? So the old boss, he knew the person. He knew that the person, that engineer, is a strange person. He is hardly willing to have small talk. He will never or hardly shows up when it is tea time or coffee time. When there is a party, he will hardly show up. Small talk is very essential. It is a quality of life. They don't spend time on it. They consider it ridiculous. They like sameness. They stay in their office for many, many hours. The old boss knew how to handle this man. But now there comes a new boss. And a new boss most of the time means that everything has to be changed. Maybe even the color of the window, the color of the walls. And that is also a moment that problems arises between the worker who is partly fulfilling autism and a new boss, because our engineer, he can't stand for all the new things that are to be introduced. And then many people with autism, they will end burned out, and the problem again and again is not seen, practically not seen, into clinical practice. The same holds with marriage. The start is fine. It's sameness. But then there is a child. Well, if there is one source of a change, then it is a child. So from a statistical point of view, many people who are partly fulfilling these criteria, the marriage will end into trouble and a divorce. I am the main editor of the Dutch Scientific Journal of Autism, and I can tell you that these issues are really at stake. Also, when it comes to research, we are talking about older people, and again, these problems are hardly recognized. And what people need is more information about what it means, autism and its connotations, and that there is a normal distribution, and some people are the clinical cases, but many people are just not fulfilling the clinical case, but nevertheless show all kinds of signs. Okay, you have learned now three things. First, that it is a heterogeneous disorder. Secondly, it is not only concerning children, but only adults. And thirdly, much of the research is producing inconsistent findings because of the fact that the samples who are joining the experiment are rather small. And then given the diversity, it leads to a lot of misunderstandings. Okay, next slide.
I think we are slowly running out of time.
Oh, that is a pity. Yeah, that is heck. Oh, okay, we continue then next week with this. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, but it is the way it was.
Sorry, can I ask you think about the essay, please? Because I have never done this kind of assignment, so I don't know how to move and how to choose the topic for my essay. I'm studying to become a teacher and for primary school, and I would like to specialize for special needs. And so I think that it's really interesting, the ADHD topic. And in particular, about the motivation and the connection of the motivation. But I don't understand if I can focus on this topic, or if it's better if I choose a topic that we don't do in the lesson.
No, of course you can choose a topic very much related to what I am explaining to you. You can also choose a topic which is less related to what I am talking right now. I would say try to choose for a topic you have very much interesting in it. And go to the library and see then how far you come. And don't make the paper too broad. I mean, I think that motivation and ADHD, that is... that is a good topic. We have discussed it. You don't have to go so much into detail when it comes to physiological issues. Although, when you are interested, why not?
Okay. But
you can also talk about motivation in the class. How to get people with ADHD motivated in the classroom?
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about this. About sorry. Study a little bit the motivation, and for example, I don't know, so the facial expression that you speak about now, it's really interesting, but the motivation and the ADHD in order to create maybe an environment, a school positive for these children. Yeah. I was thinking this. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you can always contact me when you have a problem with your manuscript. You still have weeks.
Okay, because it's the first time, so.
Well, that must be the first time, and don't spoil it. I mean, try to enjoy the time that you read some papers.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye bye. See you next time.
Thank you. Until next week.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.